Kirillov. All of Dostoevsky's heroes question themselves as to the meaning of life. In this, they are modern. They do not fear ridicule. What distinguishes modern sensibility from classical sensibility is that the latter thrives on moral problems and the former on metaphysical problems. In Dostoevsky's novels, the question is propounded with such intensity that it can only invite extreme solutions. Existence is illusory or it is eternal. If Dostoevsky were satisfied with this inquiry, he would be a philosopher. But he illustrates the consequences that such intellectual pastimes may have in a man's life, and in this regard he is an artist. Among those consequences, his attention is arrested particularly by the last one, which he himself calls logical suicide in his Diary of a Writer. In the installments for December 1876, indeed, he imagines the reasoning of logical suicide. Convinced that human existence is an utter absurdity for anyone without faith in immortality, the desperate man comes to the following conclusions. Since in reply to my questions about happiness I am told, through the intermediary of my consciousness, that I cannot be happy except in harmony with the great all, which I cannot conceive and shall never be in a position to conceive, it is evident. Since finally in this connection I assume both the role of the plaintiff and that of the defendant, of the accused and of the judge, and since I consider this comedy perpetrated by nature altogether stupid, and since I even deem it humiliating for me to deign to play it, in my indisputable capacity of plaintiff and defendant, of judge and accused, I condemn that nature which, with such impudent nerve, brought me into being in order to suffer. I condemn it to be annihilated with me. There remains a little humor in that position. This suicide kills himself because, on the metaphysical plane, he is vexed. In a certain sense, he is taking his revenge. This is his way of proving that he will not be had. It is known, however, that the same theme is embodied, but with the most wonderful generality, in Kirillov of the Possessed, likewise an advocate of logical suicide. Kirillov the engineer declares somewhere that he wants to take his own life because it is his idea. Obviously, the word must be taken in the proper sense. It is for an idea, a thought, that he is getting ready for death. This is the superior suicide. Progressively, in a series of scenes in which Kirillov's mask is gradually illuminated, the fatal thought driving him is revealed to us. The engineer, in fact, goes back to the arguments of the diary. He feels that God is necessary, and that he must exist, but he knows that he does not and cannot exist. "Why do you not realize," he exclaims, "that this is sufficient reason for killing oneself?" That attitude involves likewise for him some of the absurd consequences. Through indifference, he accepts letting his suicide be used to the advantage of a cause he despises. "I decided last night that I didn't care." And finally, he prepares his deed with a mixed feeling of revolt and freedom. "I shall kill myself in order to assert my insubordination, my new and dreadful liberty." It is no longer a question of revenge, but of revolt. Kirillov is consequently an absurd character, yet with this essential reservation. He kills himself. But he himself explains this contradiction, and in such a way that at the same time he reveals the absurd secret in all its purity. In truth, he adds to his fatal logic an extraordinary ambition which gives the character its full perspective. He wants to kill himself to become God. The reasoning is classic in its clarity. If God does not exist, Kirillov is God. If God does not exist, Kirillov must kill himself. Kirillov must therefore kill himself to become God. That logic is absurd, but it is what is needed. The interesting thing, however, is to give a meaning to that divinity brought to earth. That amounts to clarifying the premise, "If God does not exist, I am God," which still remains rather obscure. It is important to note at the outset that the man who flaunts that mad claim is indeed of this world. He performs his gymnastics every morning to preserve his health. He is stirred by the joy of Shatov recovering his wife. On a sheet of paper to be found after his death, he wants to draw a face sticking out his tongue at them. He is childish and irascible, passionate, methodical, and sensitive. Of the Superman, he has nothing but the logic and the obsession, whereas of man, he has the whole catalogue. Yet it is he who speaks calmly of his divinity. He is not mad, or else Dostoevsky is. Consequently, it is not a megalomaniac's illusion that excites him. and taking the words in their specific sense would, in this instance, be ridiculous. Kirillov himself helps us to understand. In reply to a question from Stavrogin, he makes clear that he is not talking of a God-man. It might be thought that this springs from concern to distinguish himself from Christ, but in reality it is a matter of annexing Christ. Kirillov, in fact, fancies for a moment that Jesus at his death did not find himself in paradise. He found out then that his torture had been useless. "The laws of nature," says the engineer, "made Christ live in the midst of falsehood and die for a falsehood." Solely in this sense, Jesus indeed personifies the whole human drama. He is the complete man, being the one who realized the most absurd condition. He is not the God-man, but the man-God, and like him, each of us can be crucified and victimized, and is, to a certain degree. The divinity in question is therefore altogether terrestrial. "For 3 years," says Kirillov, "I sought the attribute of my divinity, and I have found it. The attribute of my divinity is independence." Now can be seen the meaning of Kirillov's premise. If God does not exist, I am God. To become God is merely to be free on this earth, not to serve an immortal being. Above all, of course, it is drawing all the inferences from that painful independence. If God exists, all depends on him, and we can do nothing against his will. If he does not exist, everything depends on us. For Kirillov, as for Nietzsche, to kill God is to become God oneself. It is to realize on this earth the eternal life of which the gospel speaks. But if this metaphysical crime is enough for man's fulfillment, why add suicide? Why kill oneself and leave this world after having won freedom? That is contradictory. Kirillov is well aware of this, for he adds, "If you feel that, you are a czar, and far from killing yourself, you will live covered with glory." But men in general do not know it. They do not feel that. As in the time of Prometheus, they entertain blind hopes. They need to be shown the way and cannot do without preaching. Consequently, Kirillov must kill himself out of love for humanity. He must show his brothers a royal and difficult path on which he will be the first. It is a pedagogical suicide. Kirillov sacrifices himself, then. But if he is crucified, he will not be victimized. He remains the man-god, convinced of a death without future, imbued with evangelical melancholy. "I," he says, "am unhappy because I am obliged to assert my freedom." But once he is dead and men are at last enlightened, this earth will be peopled with czars and lighted up with human glory. Kirillov's pistol shot will be the signal for the last revolution. Thus it is not despair that urges him to death, but love of his neighbor for his own sake. Before terminating in blood an indescribable spiritual adventure, Kirillov makes a remark as old as human suffering. "All is well." This theme of suicide in Dostoevsky, then, is indeed an absurd theme. Let us merely note before going on that Kirillov reappears in other characters who themselves set in motion additional absurd themes. Stavrogin and Ivan Karamazov try out the absurd truths in practical life. They are the ones liberated by Kirillov's death. They try their skill at being czars. Stavrogin leads an ironic life, and it is well known in what regard. He arouses hatred around him. And yet the key to the character is found in his farewell letter. "I have not been able to detest anything." He is a czar in indifference. Ivan is likewise by refusing to surrender the royal powers of the mind. To those who, like his brother, prove by their lives that it is essential to humiliate oneself in order to believe, he might reply that the condition is shameful. His key word is, "everything is permitted," with the appropriate shade of melancholy. Of course, like Nietzsche, the most famous of God's assassins, he ends in madness. But this is a risk worth running, and faced with such tragic ends, the essential impulse of the absurd mind is to ask, "What does that prove?" Thus the novels, like The Diary, propound the absurd question. They establish logic unto death, exaltation, dreadful freedom, the glory of the czars become human. All is well, everything is permitted, and nothing is hateful. These are absurd judgments. But what an amazing creation in which those creatures of fire and ice seem so familiar to us. The passionate world of indifference that rumbles in their hearts does not seem at all monstrous to us. We recognize in it our everyday anxieties, and probably no one so much as Dostoevsky has managed to give the absurd world such familiar and tormenting charms. Yet what is his conclusion? Two quotations will show the complete metaphysical reversal that leads the writer to other revelations. The argument of the one who commits logical suicide having provoked protests from the critics, Dostoevsky, in the following installments of the diary, amplifies his position and concludes thus. If faith in immortality is so necessary to the human being that without it he comes to the point of killing himself, it must therefore be the normal state of humanity. Since this is the case, the immortality of the human soul exists without any doubt. Then again, in the last pages of his last novel, at the conclusion of that gigantic combat with God, some children ask Alyosha, Karamazov, is it true what religion says, that we shall rise from the dead, that we shall see one another again? And Alyosha answers, certainly, we shall see one another again. We shall joyfully tell one another everything that has happened. Thus Kirillov, Stavrogin, and Ivan are defeated. The brothers Karamazov replies to the possessed, and it is indeed a conclusion. Alyosha's case is not ambiguous, as is that of Prince Mishkin. Ill, the latter lives in a perpetual present, tinged with smiles and indifference, and that blissful state might be the eternal life of which the prince speaks. On the contrary, Alyosha clearly says, we shall meet again. There is no longer any question of suicide and of madness. What is the use for anyone who is sure of immortality and of its joys? Man exchanges his divinity for happiness. We shall joyfully tell one another everything that has happened. Thus again, Kirillov's pistol rang out somewhere in Russia, but the world continued to cherish its blind hopes. Men did not understand that. Consequently, it is not an absurd novelist addressing us, but an existential novelist. Here, too, the leap is touching and gives its nobility to the art that inspires it. It is a stirring acquiescence, riddled with doubts, uncertain and ardent. Speaking of the brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky wrote, the chief question that will be pursued throughout this book is the very one from which I have suffered consciously or unconsciously all life long, the existence of God. It is hard to believe that a novel sufficed to transform into joyful certainty the suffering of a lifetime. One commentator correctly pointed out that Dostoevsky is on Ivan's side, and that the affirmative chapters took 3 months of effort, whereas what he called the blasphemies were written in 3 weeks in a state of excitement. There is not one of his characters who does not have that thorn in the flesh, who does not aggravate it or seek a remedy for it in sensation or immortality. In any case, let us remain with this doubt. Here is a work which, in a chiaroscuro more gripping than the light of day, permits us to seize man's struggle against his hopes. Having reached the end, the creator makes his choice against his characters. That contradiction thus allows us to make a distinction. It is not an absurd work that is involved here, but a work that propounds the absurd problem. Dostoevsky's reply is humiliation, shame, according to Stavrogin. An absurd work, on the contrary, does not provide a reply. That is the whole difference. Let us note this carefully in conclusion. What contradicts the absurd in that work is not its Christian character, but rather its announcing a future life. It is possible to be Christian and absurd. There are examples of Christians who do not believe in a future life. In regard to the work of art, it should therefore be possible to define one of the directions of the absurd analysis that could have been anticipated in the preceding pages. It leads to propounding the absurdity of the gospel. It throws light upon this idea, fertile in repercussions, that convictions do not prevent incredulity. On the contrary, it is easy to see that the author of The Possessed, familiar with these paths, in conclusion took a quite different way. The surprising reply of the creator to his characters, of Dostoevsky to Kirillov, can indeed be summed up thus. Existence is illusory, and it is eternal.